welcome to Michigan HockeyCast 3.7, where if you stick around long enough, you will hear Alex and I debate about wolves, or wolfs, or wolvi. So right before I hit the record button, you had told me that you thought the Akron game from 2013 was a fun game, and I'm going to give you a very short period of time to convince me of this before we move on to the first thing we're going to talk about today.
We're talking about football, by the way.
Okay, Akron 2013 I feel like should be burned into most people's minds, but maybe they've just flushed everything out.
I mean, I wasn't a big Michigan fan in 2013, and Akron, you know, you go to a game in Big Ten versus MAC, you don't expect a good football game, and the fact it came down to the final goal line stand, I mean, that was more exciting than I was expecting that day. So
you're saying from a non-Michigan fan perspective.
Yeah, it was an entertaining
game.
That's
fair. All right. I will say that that's okay. No, I don't know. I was not expecting that take. But anyway, hi, I am David, and this is Alex, and we are doing a special Michigan Hockey Cast talking about...
It's a Christmas cast.
A Christmas cast. I like that. We're going to not necessarily talk about games because there weren't any, but we're going to talk about sort of some news and then go over what we use to measure the team. And then we've corralled, I guess, some questions from hopefully all of you who are listening, and we will get to as many of those or the ones that can fit into how we can talk about stuff as we can. So the first thing is the first bit of news is the second half of the season schedule has been released, which is a lot earlier than we both predicted last week.
Yeah, that was the final line in last week's podcast.
We will probably find out sometime in mid-January. It has actually been released a few days ago, and I think it's fine, right? Like, Michigan has...
There were no teams that I did not expect to play on the schedule, so that's a plus.
6, 7, 8, and then 2 half series, and they have, I think, 4 or 5 Friday-Saturday series, which is... I would definitely prefer Friday, Saturday nights than trying to figure out how to get to games on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. So they have a weekend series, a home and away versus State on the 8th and 9th. They have a home series versus Ohio State on January 15th and 16th. They then go to Notre Dame on a Thursday, Friday, the January 21st and 22nd.
And those games we'll probably get to watch because Notre Dame's always got a TV package.
Yes, I assume at least one will be on NBC Sports.
Yep.
Then the next week, we have our Wednesday-Thursday where we host Penn State.
And there's a long break in road trips. The next 5 games after Notre Dame are home.
Yes.
So Michigan plays Notre Dame on the 22nd of January. They don't go on the road again until February 19th. So that's almost a month of no travel.
That's interesting. And so they play Notre Dame on the 21st and 22nd, and then they actually have a week off, and they don't play until February 3rd and 4th. So there will be sort of that bye week after the first 3 series. Then there's the quick turnaround in so they play February 3rd and 4th hosting Penn State, which is our Wednesday, Thursday. The following Tuesday, they host Michigan State.
My birthday's on a Saturday this year, and no games on my birthday this year.
That's good.
I was wondering about that.
Mine too. Mine's on a Saturday as well, and there are no games on it, which I always prefer because I like to do other things. But anyway, so they play February 9th. On a Tuesday at Yost against Michigan State, and then they go to Wisconsin that next weekend for the 13th and 14th, but it's a Saturday Sunday for whatever reason. And then the next 3 are weekend series, the 19th, 20th of February, the 26th, 27th of February, and the 5th and 6th of February. And then they close the season on a Wednesday, obviously, in Munn.
Yeah, and it's interesting sort of mix. I mean, Minnesota, the 5th, 6th, that'll be a fascinating series to watch in March. That'll be a big measuring stick. We don't know where Michigan will be in the national picture at that point, but that's one of those scenarios where you can be talking about quality wins and things like that at that point in the schedule. You kind of bookend that with Arizona State and Michigan State, which in theory are 2 of the easier games on the schedule, maybe. I don't know. Arizona State's played better as of recently.
Mm-hmm.
Funny thing is that I have a friend who goes to Arizona State, and his birthday is the 28th of February, So, or the series right before that. So I sent him a text and I was like, your early birthday present is getting watching your team get whipped again. And he never responded. So
he didn't respond.
I texted about something else later and he responded to that. So I just assume he's a coward. That's my conclusion.
Does he listen to this podcast?
Probably not. Oh. Next time we talk, I'm going to definitely roast him. So,
see, and you can't even say, hey, you can come up here and go to this series. Although, I don't know why if you'd want to travel to Michigan when you're in Arizona in February, but maybe you could have done it the opposite way. But
he lives in Virginia now, so
oh,
he graduated in the spring. But
oh, he's already graduated. Oh, well.
He's old like you.
Yeah, we had a debate about that earlier, but anyway. Okay, so that's the schedule. It's fine. I don't have a lot of takes other than most of the days aren't too bad. Michigan doesn't. They do have...
And all the World Juniors guys will be back. That's important to
Yeah, and that was one of the questions someone asked is, like, will Michigan's guys make it back? And I would think that there's no way that they couldn't, right? Because the gold medal game's on, like, the 4th or the 5th, and the first game is on the 8th. I mean, yep. They would be back for
as
that.
As long as so. They don't get COVID while they're there.
Yeah, that's something else that could happen. So that's pretty much the schedule. The second part that we wanted to discuss is just, you know, when we read through the comments of, like, my breakdowns or, you know, sometimes will happen on some of your posts or have happened in the past, it's like people don't understand terms or what they mean or why they're relevant. So we've just kind of compiled a list of different things. So some of this is going to be Hockey 101 type stuff, and then it might get into 201, 301, and then maybe a couple of 401 things. But and some of it is... just kind of metrics that we look at. They may or may not be favorites of yours or of certain scouts or teams or whatever, but we try to find ways to measure what Michigan is or isn't doing or their opponents and try to predict sports, which is usually a bad idea. So the first thing I wrote down is, like, you know, obviously when we're tweeting, we shorten to acronyms because it's hard to do that, but, like, so the defensive zone, the neutral zone, the offensive zone, and obviously those are the different thirds on the ice broken up by the blue lines, and you know, and then the next thing I'm going to define is an OMR, which is an odd man rush, but that's sort of like when we would talk about the neutral zone trap, that's where, and you can even go into this a little more detail, but it's basically where you kind of stack a lot of guys between the blue lines because there are rules for offsides, but you can force teams into kind of bottlenecking them and forcing turnovers there if you stack guys in the right places.
Yeah. I mean, every team has their own strategies and the way they go about things, but, you know, the neutral zone is kind of the area where you're setting up how you want your team to go and where you use your forwards, how far they are up on the play forechecking. Some teams put two or three guys up in the offensive zone.
Mm-hmm.
Others sit back a little bit and put them more in the neutral zone, how far the defensemen come up. I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can go about utilizing your players and setting things up.
Based on sort of who your exact players are and what their skill sets are, I would guess, right?
And, I mean, the systems you're running, et cetera.
Yeah, that too. Okay. So then the next thing that sort of what got me into trying to cover Michigan hockey was like the late red era of constant OMRs, as we call them, which are odd man rushes, which is where you have a defender that a lot of times gets pinches up into the play or tries to make a play in the offensive zone and gets taken out of the play because a opposing forward, generally, sometimes a defenseman, will get by him. And then all of a sudden you have one guy back, or you can transition the puck from your defensive zone to the offensive zone with your centerman beating the other team's centerman, and then all of a sudden you have a 3-on-2. And those are, like, good scoring chances that you wouldn't necessarily count as repeatable or as part of, like, a system that you develop in your offensive zone or what you try to do. Like, you can say, all right, this team's defensemen are sloppy either on changes or on how they pinch or where their positioning is. And you can, like, set up, like, let's try to take advantage of that. But an odd man rush is not necessarily like an offensive system. All it is getting out of position so that the other team now has a chance to have a nice goal scoring opportunity because of, like, a breakdown in the neutral zone or the offensive zone.
And you can run different systems based on your risk tolerance and your willingness
right.
to allow odd man rushes to happen. And if you're going to play more defensive style, then you're going to do certain things with your positioning to take away potential odd man rushes. I mean,
right.
Michigan playing Notre Dame a few weeks ago did not get many odd man rushes in that series. Notre Dame didn't either. Like, those are games where only there's a couple, maybe, in the entire game.
Right. And, you know, these are things that are... can be game changers, of sort of speak, because like you can be dominating puck possession in the offensive end, and if you have a bad change or you create sort of, or you give up an odd man rush, I mean, that's a pretty, usually you get a pretty high goal, a high chance to score a goal on that, because a guy's going to either have an open shot or a really open shot if he gets a pass across, or you can get, if you have a 3-on-1, a lot of times there's like two passes that can be set up, and then you're basically forcing a goalie to make probably one of the best saves he's going to have to face in that game.
And we sometimes have problems defining odd man rushes. There's sometimes things little, you're like, oh, was that an odd man rush or was it not? Sometimes it sort of pops up on a more minute scale. I mean, the classic odd man rush is a 2-on-1
right.
where there's two guys away, there's one defenseman back. It's just very clear. Like, those are things teams practice all the time. You see that. That's the classic odd man rush. So it's very clearly a version of it, but a lot of them aren't as clear cut, and sometimes you're trying to fit, and there's guys back checking back, and so it's not always obvious what is and what isn't.
No, and basically, like the minimum for me is that the puck has to be to change hands or sticks, I guess, at least in the neutral zone. Like, and this is the next one, is like a DZTO is what we refer to them as, a defensive zone turnover, which is where you have the puck in your zone, not where the opposition does, where you have the puck and they either forecheck you or you make a bad pass or a puck jumps off your stick, and then now all of a sudden the other team has a good scoring opportunity. And sometimes those can look like odd man rushes because they happen at your blue line as you're trying to exit, or they happen as you're trying to make a breakout pass sort of across your defensive zone, and it looks like then what becomes a 2-on-1. But the way that I would define it, I think you would agree, most people would agree, is that that's not necessarily an odd man rush. That's a defensive zone turnover, because you turn the puck over in your own zone. An odd man rush would occur in the neutral zone or in your attacking zone, where now all of a sudden you have like a sprint coming back down the ice of where you have 2 or 3 on 1 or 2 or something like that. And it's where you have, like you said, a 2-on-1. It's just where the opposition outnumbers the defense, or the attackers outnumber the defenders. Like, you wouldn't count it if it's like a 2-on-2, because that isn't really a bad transitional play. You have enough guys back. Now you just have to defend right or have good communication if they switch or things like that. But it's where you don't have enough defenders back to check every attacker. And I think it's different these days, because I think now with you, like we were talking about this a little bit in prep about defensemen, but nowadays you have, it's very common for guys like, who we saw Quinn Hughes or Cale Makar with the Avs to jump the play. And we saw Cam York get a goal off of this at Penn State, where he was sort of the fourth man in, where Penn State got three guys back, but York saw the play, was the fourth guy in, and kind of created sort of that odd man rush, because even though it's, you know, Penn State probably had all the guys they anticipate having back, Cam York beat the wingers down the ice, and all of a sudden now they don't have enough guys to check him too. The pass comes to him in the center. He glides down the slot and scores on a nice backhand. So, you know, they've kind of evolved over time, but now especially these days, they become a lot bigger with active defensemen. And Michigan does have defensemen that can be activated in that sense, and we've talked about that a lot. But that's kind of the difference between an odd man rush and a defensive zone turnover.
I mean, hockey as a whole has opened back up in the last 10 or so years. Not as much at the college level, but in some of the games Michigan plays, absolutely. Mm-hmm. If you go to some sort of ECAC teams where it's really tight, and obviously Notre Dame tries to play that way, as does MSU, but definitely in terms of the NHL now, we are seeing a lot more defensemen get involved, and that can lead to more odd man rushes. But if you wind the clocks back to the 80s, I mean, they were extremely common in that era when scoring was elevated and the game was much more wide open than it is now. And so, you know, there's trends rise and fall over time.
Right. So then the next thing that we were going to get to is sort of the Corsi / Fenwick. And these are kind of two different methods for tracking possession of the puck. Obviously, soccer is known for its sort of possession statistics, and they probably just count, I'm guessing, time on the ball, because you can have clocks that do that, and it's pretty easy to track that. In hockey, everything moves a little bit quicker and faster, so you can't just have two clocks going. So the way that Corsi and Fenwick track possession is by attempts at the net in even strength. So when we do that, we take out all the power play attempts when, like, it's posted. The numbers that we get from collegehockeynews.com, they will post overall possession rates. The ones that we generally focus on a little bit more are even strength, because when you're on the power play, you're generally expected to always get a lot more shots on the net anyway, because you're going to have an open guy, so someone is always going to be able to shoot. So what you're looking at is...
So if you include power plays, then you take into account the imbalance of the game necessarily, right?
Right.
So in some of the more recent games, which we've talked about, where Michigan was heavily shorthanded compared to the opponent, then that distorts the possession figure, right? If one team is shorthanded a lot more than the other.
Exactly.
And that's not really what you're trying to see, is who is controlling play when both teams are even strength.
All things being equal, you have your team and they have their team on the ice. There's not an imbalance. Who has the puck more and who is taking more shots? And so it doesn't, in Corsi, and the difference between Corsi and Fenwick, and we picked Corsi to go with, I've thought about transitioning to Fenwick. I don't know. That's still up for discussion in the future, but Fenwick basically takes out blocks, because when you shoot a puck at the net, four things can happen. One, it can go in, which is a goal. Two, it can be saved, which is counted as a shot. Three, it can miss absolutely everything and hit the boards, I guess it would always be the boards. And four, it can be blocked by a defender. And Fenwick takes out blocks because I think the theory behind that is that you have someone who blocked your shot, and therefore that doesn't necessarily count because they were in good defensive position. So if, like, what Brian and I have referred to for years as a downing is when Michael Downing, who played for Michigan probably 5, 6, 7 years ago, would take these slap shots from the point, and he would hit the first guy in front of him, and the puck would go shooting past him, and he would sometimes get beaten to the puck, and you'd have an odd man rush, a 1-on-0 going the other way, because you just hit the first guy in front of you, which is not, like, your goal. And it's sort of like in soccer too, where if you have a corner kick or you have a free kick and you hit the first guy in front of you, like, you have to always beat the first guy. Like, you can't shoot it right into the guy right in front of you. Like, that's never really considered a good play, and you probably in this situation shouldn't be rewarded with a shot or in terms of possession. So that's the difference between those. We count the blocks. We could easily not. It's just once you're kind of entrenched in one, you sort of stick with it, I guess.
The difference between Corsi and Fenwick is not very big. Especially NHL stats of different guys, I mean, the Corsi and the Fenwick are pretty similar.
You mean like what they produce?
Yeah.
In terms of percentages?
Yeah.
Okay.
In the NHL, they're often displayed as percentages. So, team will be, say, 53% for Corsi. That is, you're controlling it 53% on 100 times.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But when you just look at individual players, individual teams, it's splitting hairs. There are some teams that have some discrepancy between the two, but it's not very big, and you get a general feel no matter which one you're using.
Yeah. And it's, like I said, it's just trying to get an idea of who has the puck and who's sort of controlling play. And you can argue that, someone asked me a Spurs question that I'll address later, but, Mourinho comes out and says, he who has the ball is going to make more mistakes. So there is a thought that there is an idea of play that, hey, if we force someone else to have the ball or the puck in this sense, that they'll make more mistakes and we can kill them in OMRs and stuff like that. I don't necessarily
know. That's not very common, though.
In hockey, it isn't.
Teams definitely like to play possession more, and that, I mean, it depends on style. But
I mean, kind of. I mean, Notre Dame doesn't necessarily.
Not necessarily, but.
Necessarily.
Corsi and Fenwick were at the beginning of the analytics revolution in the NHL, at least. Much the way that, identifying OBP as a better metric than batting average was at the forefront of the analytics revolution in baseball. So, they were kind of the first stat that people really started to look at. And so this is kind of like when the lore of Pavel Datsyuk began, because Datsyuk's Corsi numbers were always just off the charts.
Insane.
And there's some guys like that are... like Mark Stone on the Vegas Golden Knights is one of those guys that analytics gurus love. And in part, it's because, they're good possession players.
He just has the puck all the time. Yeah. And last time I checked, in order to score a goal, you generally need the puck. So,
hey, not all the time. I'm trying to think of what the guy's name was that got credit for the goal. I think it was Perry Barazan that got credit for the goal where the Oilers put it in their own net, and he was sitting on the bench because he was the last Flames player to touch it. He dumped it in, and then the Oilers scored an own goal. But
I love Alex stories. They're always great.
That's a famous one.
Yeah.
In the 1986 Smythe Division Final, Game 7, I think it was.
Wow, but that's impressive. Did you do research on that, or did you just know that off the top of your head?
I mean, I didn't research that now, but that's off the top of my head.
Are you a trivia guy?
Decently so, yeah.
Yeah, I can believe it. All right, so the next part is the house. And this is, sometimes it's also called like the heart. It looks like a home plate. But basically, you take, what I do is I take, well, when we used to get shot charts, we'd do this. So I haven't this year, but hopefully in the future we'll get shot charts again. But you break possession or Corsi into two different things. And one is like inside the house, which is basically you start at the crease and you go out to the dots, which are in the middle of the faceoff, lower faceoff circles, and then up to the top of the circles, I believe, and then across. So it's kind of basically just the center of the ice. It's just like, you know, the best shooting angles on the ice are going to be from that area. And so if kind of like what you're looking at is, are the shot attempts and the shots and all those different things that you're giving up, are they from the edges, like around the boards or back at the blue line or from the corners, or are they from like the house, which is like right in the middle? And if you just keep giving up shots from the house, like those are as good a scoring opportunities probably as you're going to get. I mean, obviously the closer you get to the goal, that, you know, blah, 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 all that. But if when we reference, oh, we, you know, Michigan was able to keep, I don't know, they haven't done this really a lot lately. Maybe Wisconsin to the edges, and Wisconsin's had to shoot from the boards and they had to shoot from the perimeter and stuff like that. Like, that's kind of what you want them to do because, you know, the puck could hit a number of things. The goalie has longer to track it. He can usually see it easier. The reaction time isn't as great. You know, all those different things. Like, that's what you're looking for. But if you're giving up shots from 10, 12 feet out in front of you, right in front of you, like, eventually those are going to go in. Like, no goalie's going to just be able to save an extremely high percentage of those.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. And then even smaller than that, and this is where it gets into really hockey 101, but you have like the slot, the high slot, the crease. The crease is obviously where the goalie is. The slot is sort of between the circles in the middle of the house, and then the high slot like drifts out towards the top of it where, you know, and I've even also heard people say that shots that come from straight away could almost be counted on like house type shots, even though they're farther from a distance. There, it's still a good look to shoot sort of right down the alley of like from out, even out by the blue line, which is a distance, but given the angle and if you have traffic in front, those can be considered pretty high dangerous chances too. And that sort of thing, we talk about high danger areas, it's mostly just like around the crease, from the slot, from the house, in the center. I mean, just think of it from a geometrical standpoint, which is a great thing to bring up on a hockey podcast, but you just, the more of the net that you have to shoot at, the more that you force the goalie to take away, the farther you force him to come out to cut down his angles, the better your chances are of scoring a goal or making a pass to another side to score a goal. So the dots, obviously, just the centers of the face-off circles, and that's sort of on the fringes of the house. But that's also become, probably as the 1-3-1 has gotten bigger over the last 5-6 years or whatever it's been, very common points to shoot from on the power play, I would say. Like, we see Brisson shooting from there a number of times in the early part of Michigan's power play chances, as they got him isolated on one of the dots and he just rapid fired, I think, what was against Arizona State.
Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of the Ovechkin effect.
Yes.
I mean, he sometimes shoots from higher up towards the half wall up to the point, but definitely if you have those gunners along the wall, then those are guys you can try and set up.
And the point of a power play is to move the goalie, right? Like, it's not to get as many shots as you can. It's to move the goalie. So if you can get one, a pass that goes all the way across, especially like a diagonal where you change the level, like, that's what you want to do. And if you can have a guy shooting from there, you're forcing the goalie to go from one side of the pipes to the other, a lot of times with traffic in between. So,
yeah, and ideally someone screening.
Right.
That knows how to do it correctly.
The last thing that we check on sort of power play type stuff is like shots per minute. And I think your goal generally is to be above one shot per minute, if possible. I mean, it depends on the quality of shots, but
so the idea is that you should not be shooting all the time. Like, it depends on the situation. If it's a 5-on-3, then maybe you can get away with that. But one of the issues is that if when we talk about Michigan's very much beleaguered penalty kill at the moment, when do they do, you know, perform well? It's when they get the puck. And if you shoot, that's generally how, I mean, we talk about this. Michigan really only takes the puck away on the penalty kill when someone shoots and then they get the rebound.
Yeah.
And so if you're shooting a ton, then there's the worry that, you know, that's in some sense, if it doesn't go in, that's a risk opportunity to give it to the opponent.
Sure.
Some teams like to really take their time and set it up. That's always one of those things fans talk about in sort of frustrating fashion, is the team that stands there and takes 75 seconds and passes it back and forth and back and forth and back, and they're just waiting for that one opportunity, because the argument is you only need one great opportunity. And if you get all the finishing right, that one opportunity is all that matters. So there isn't really a general rule. It's kind of a matter of personal preference. And then obviously you have Penn State that just likes to shoot. So,
yeah. I think that the reason that, and I get what your point and what you're saying, the reason that I track that is more like, all right, how many dangerous opportunities are you really sort of creating in a power play? Like, do you get one good look 15 or 20 seconds in and then do nothing for the next minute and a half? And, you know, how good was your power play? Then how effective was it? Because obviously you're not going to score on every one, and you're probably not even going to score on that many. But, and this is kind of what we're getting to, is the last thing we're pretty much going to talk about is, you know, an effective power play percentage scores on what, 20 to 25%?
Yeah, at least at the NHL level. And then college hockey can often be to 30%.
A little higher.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, expecting your power play, I mean, if you're in the teens on the power play, that's at any level is not going to be a super effective, right? Like, you're looking to crack 20 at the minimum, I would say. Especially if you have a good, if you want to be viewed as having a good power play, or you want to be sort of like threatening teams of, hey, you can't take penalties against us because we're going to convert.
Best power play percentage in NHL history was 31.88% by the 77-78 Montreal Canadiens back when they were monster dynasty.
And then, so then you kind of invert that for the penalty kill. Like, penalty kills, I remember Ohio State had like a 90% a few years ago, and that, to me, that was just absurd. Like, nobody kills those kinds of penalty rates.
The top number in college hockey is normally around 90% or so, 91, 92.
Right.
That's like the number one in the country most years.
But that's not,
and
it's
that
not
also,
always feasible.
And again, those teams tend to come from the conferences that really play a more
defensive style and pack a bunch of guys in. And yeah, no. So, you know, when we're looking at Michigan, like, we want, I would say I would be pretty happy with them being somewhere around 25% power play conversion rate, and you would want their penalty kill to be somewhere between 80 and 85-ish.
Yeah.
In that range. And, you know, teams that are outside of that sort of range on one side or another are going to be teams that we're going to be like, oh, this is a team that you can score on the power play, or this is a team that, you know, defends it really well, you know, that sort of thing. So I think that's it that I have for definitions and terminology in terms of like what we tend to talk about and focus on. Do you have anything else you want to add to this?
Nope.
Okay, well, let's take a break and we will answer some of your serious and maybe some of your not so serious questions.
If you find yourself in the penalty box in Ann Arbor or Metro Detroit, you want a Michigan man arguing your case. Call former prosecutor and now criminal defense attorney Jonathan Paul, the Michigan Law Grad, at 248-924-9458, or visit his website at michiganlawgrad.com.
I wish you a Merry Christmas. I wish you a Merry Christmas. I wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Oh, bring us some figgy pudding. Oh, bring us some figgy pudding. Oh, bring us some figgy pudding and bring it out here. We won't go until we got some. We won't go until we got some. We won't go until we got some. So bring some out here.
So I was kind of thrilled. Like, we actually got a fair amount of questions.
We promoted it pretty well.
We tweeted about it a few times, and then you put up a very nice board post that generated some talk about...
It's a beautiful post.
It was amazing. You should be a marketer. And so we got, I don't know, three or four decent questions there. There were a number that were tweeted to us. And they're, you know, they're kind of all over the place. Some of them we're just going to kind of fit together because it's just sort of topic-y stuff. And then we're going to get through as many of these as sort of we can and sort of make sense. And then if we have time, I will talk a little bit of Spurs and the Matt Campbell discussion for whatever reason. People brought it up or someone asked me about it on Saturday. So the first thing is a question that says, do you view Michigan's struggles on the power on the penalty kill as more personnel or coaching?
Well, if the question is Michigan doesn't have talent enough to kill the penalty right, I mean, that's, yeah, that it, from that perspective, it's all coaching. I mean, there's plenty of teams that are great on special teams that, like, even on the power play, right, that don't have, quote-unquote, elite finishers. I mean, Ohio State has often been an excellent team for special teams, and that's the way they play. And Ohio State does not have elite talent whatsoever. They only have one or two draft guys and none even close to... I mean, they're not in the same stratosphere, Michigan, talent-wise.
Especially this year.
Yeah, but even most years. I mean, you think about some of the guys they had. I mean, Tanner Osinski was a great player. He was a seventh-round pick in the NHL. I mean, they don't have a lot of talent at Ohio State, and they turn out great special teams units that have far exceeded Michigan's. So,
especially on the kill.
Yeah.
Their kill has been phenomenal for a while.
So any team with any talent level can put up a good special team system if it's coached correctly at the college level. There is some argument that it's personnel-based in the sense that Michigan has a lot of guys that didn't play a ton of defense necessarily in their, you know, junior level, right? When you bring in top-tier scorers, those guys aren't necessarily as known for being great defensive players, but most of those guys don't play on the penalty kill. So in terms of the guys Michigan trots out there, you expect them to be able to kill penalties good enough to get it done, and certainly with the quality of offensive players you have, you expect your power play to be good enough. So special teams, you know, that's coaching stuff.
And it's not like Michigan has a sieve for a goalie. Like, they have one of the best goalies they've had in a long time, if not ever. So you can't even sit there and say, hey, we're checking guys, our goalie isn't making saves. I mean, that's probably not happening.
And in one of the oldest cliches of all, your best penalty killer is your goalie.
So, yeah, I would agree. It's probably some coaching issues. It could be some... I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean it's always structure. It could be, like, player development or guys knowing what they need to do. I mean, those are two very different things. But I don't think it's because Michigan doesn't have the talent to kill penalties.
Yeah,
at least
sure.
Recently. Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Okay, so now this enters an interesting sort of two or three questions that will all build up on each other. The first one is, what are reasonable expectations for how long current and upcoming draft picks on the team will stay on campus?
So this is one where it's tough to have a definitive answer, in part because the guys that are on the roster are, a number of them are not drafted. And
three.
So it's tough.
Three of them, I believe?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's kind of tough to know how a team is going to approach a guy when you don't know what that team is and you don't really know what their track record is. So I feel much more comfortable projecting that Cam York is not going to be around next season.
Yeah, well, he's a first-round pick, and
I mean,
there was debate if he'd come back this year.
Yeah, and in the offseason, there was talk about him where he was, I don't remember what the quote was exactly, but he was definitely talking about, like, I'm going to come back here for one more year and, like, get better at offense, and then I'll be ready to leave. It wasn't like that necessarily, but that was what I read from that quote. And guys...
that wasn't word for word?
And as we'll talk about in a moment, and just looking back at research, at guys picked in the lottery, those guys almost never get a third year in college.
Yeah.
So he's gone. Beecher, he was towards the back end of the first round, which is where guys sometimes will get third years. And certainly when you look at his production at the current moment, you are not happy about that right now if you're either Michigan or Boston who drafted him. And
or probably Johnny Beecher.
Sure. So, you know, it kind of comes down to, how does Beecher look in the second half of the year? How does he play? And then, you know, there's always a chance that the Bruins could say, you know what, we just don't think he's progressing at the right rate at Michigan, that Might be Mel's fault. I don't know. We don't know how the organization thinks about it, but there's certainly the possibility that they could say, you know what, we're going to place him in the AHL and we're going to have our guys in Providence, you know, do with him what we want him to learn.
Yeah, and there's the interesting thing about him, and we should spend a little bit of time talking about this because that's been sort of near the forefront of the question marks of about Michigan this year is, you know, you mentioned and some other people have talked about how there were sort of the draft grade range on him was vast.
Yeah, so there are some guys, I mean, there were different people who felt that Beecher was not even close to a second-round pick, let alone a first-rounder. There were others, like the team that drafted him, that thought he was a first-round pick. Now, obviously, the team that is drafting him thinks highly of him because they drafted him. So we don't have to pretend how Boston thinks about him. We know how Boston thinks about him because they took him with a first-round pick. So they think he's capable of quite a bit, which means that they're probably not very happy and kind of unexpectedly disappointed with the season at this juncture. But, you know, Beecher can put it all together in the second half. I don't know. We'll see how the season rolls along for him, and it's a very, very unclear at the moment.
I think that a lot of this is what you just said. We're looking at what are expectations for a lot of these guys. Well, a lot of it depends on how do they play the second half of the season, because you come in and you look at who they have and you think, all right, I hope they get some of these guys back next year. And they kind of have a really good start first couple series, and it looks like, whoa, will we get any of these guys back next year? And then things kind of fade and turn off, and they start playing teams like Notre Dame that are very, really well-coached and experienced, and the same thing with Minnesota, and then they have the run-and-gun, you know, Nittany Lions, and things don't go quite as well, and you're thinking, okay, now there's a lot of these guys are starting to get pushed off the puck. Guys are being, you know, physically moved and being shut down by players that know what they're doing. And when that happens, you know, that doesn't, I mean, it doesn't, you don't look quite as flashy and as good. And now you're playing against sort of more of a measuring stick than some of the teams maybe they played against in the first few series.
Other guys like Brendan Brisson, I think, is very likely to be back for, probably likely to be back for a second season at this juncture with his production.
Yeah.
Again, it's generally that it's a matter of do the teams feel like they have more to learn from that level? And if a guy is very clearly too good for that level, then they get moved up a lot of times. And Brisson is not in that threshold now. But again, some teams may want to move them to the AHL where they can monitor it more closely. Depends on the team's preference.
And that's something else that you had an interesting point about this, but, you know, the CHL is going to start in a month or two, and then you're going to have, you still, you know, guys have been drafted into that league too, but they decide to play for Michigan. If guys want sort of a season and a half left where they finish playing for Michigan this year and still want to play in CHL, could, like, teams have them go over there, play an extra X number of games, and then maybe sign or with the professional team in the summer? Is that a thing or no?
I mean, this is an extraordinary year, so we've never had anything like this.
Right.
To really classify. I mean, nothing like that has happened, you know, previously, really. I mean, just in terms of you look at other top draft picks that, I mean, I think about sometimes things really, a lot of times it's like if a guy's not doing well at all. Like, I mean, I think about, he wasn't in this group I was looking at, but it was just outside the lottery range, was Dennis Chalowski, who was taken by the Red Wings 16th a few years back. And Chalowski played his first year then at St. Cloud State in the NCAAs and just really performed extremely poorly. And so the Red Wings yanked him out of the NCAA and they moved him to the BCHL. And he went out there and played for a little while. To just try and change things up. And so that's kind of the precedent. I mean, I don't know. It could happen that they put someone in that kind of league. But also, you know, it's not like they're not going to be playing many games at Michigan. I mean, here's the thing. If Michigan plays out its full season, it's going to be close to the normal amount that a college hockey team would play. And so, I mean, it's not like they've only played three games and they need to be moved to a different league to actually get games in. I mean,
and they'd have to, you know, get in with another team, find line mates, break up, sort of like, yeah, I completely get all that. So
then the other guys haven't been drafted yet. And actually, we'll throw Jacob Triscott in there. And, you know, Triscott, I think, is probably a four-year guy. I mean,
you think so?
Three or four. I mean, he was a later round pick. Those kinds of guys tend to
stick
for a while. I mean, Tanner Lozinski got all 4 years at Ohio State. I mean,
mm-hmm.
So the thing is that NHL teams only have a certain number of contracts they can offer.
Right.
So they can't sign every draft pick.
Right.
And so they let late round picks stay a long time. So I would expect a while for him. And then at the other guys, it's more questionable, right? And it's less clear sort of what's going to happen. Now, Owen Power was the number one ranked guy in Bob McKenzie's draft rankings that came out last week, which is significant because Bob McKenzie's draft rankings are the only draft rankings you should pay attention to. You can read other scouts to see what other scouts think, and there are other scouts who are, you know, valuable because of their individual insight.
Uh-huh.
McKenzie is not really a scout. McKenzie's an insider. So McKenzie is the Woj of the NHL.
Okay.
And McKenzie's draft rankings are not what Bob McKenzie thinks of each prospect. Mm. It's a poll of scouts who work for teams.
Oh.
So McKenzie's draft rankings, if you take each ranking offered by a scout and say, which is the closest to what actually happens? It's McKenzie's by a mile. Because his is a survey of people who actually are making decisions.
Yeah.
And, you know, sorry, Corey Perlman, but he's not making decisions. He works for The Athletic, right?
Yeah.
Same thing with Peters at ESPN. I mean, those are journalists and scouts, not people that actually make decisions. So the fact that Power was leading McKenzie's is very significant. However, I retweeted a different scout yesterday who just talks to different people and organizations, and McKenzie reiterated this, which is that it's wide open. I mean, there's as many as 8 to 10 guys that are being talked about at number one overall. So it's all over the place. Anything could happen.
Does Power drop out of the top 10?
No.
Okay.
I would feel very certain about that because his physical profile is not going to allow that.
Yeah.
A guy that size is not going to fall out of the top 10. But, you know, where Power goes is a big question mark. What I will say about Power is he's a defenseman, and defensemen can sometimes be rushed along a little quicker if a team wants that to happen. Noah Hanifin was ripped right into the NHL at 18 after being a top 5 pick, having played 1 year in college before he was drafted, which is exactly Power's situation.
Right.
So that could happen. And certainly if you go number one overall, number one overall tends to go straight into the NHL right away. And this year might be different because if a guy isn't perceived as NHL ready enough. And by the way, the Hanifin story is not really a great one in the sense that Hanifin's a fine player, but he's not worth the number 5 pick at this juncture in his career. He's become a decent defenseman, but he's not a star, and he's not a number one guy. He's not a top pair guy in Calgary. He plays on the second pair and is kind of just plateaued.
Okay.
So I don't know if they rushed him along too fast or what exactly happened, but that's not, you know, the cheeriest example. We'll just go with that. As opposed to Cale Makar, who went fourth overall, they gave him 2 years after being drafted before he came to the league, and he ran Rookie of the Year, and Quinn Hughes got another year after being drafted.
He also won the Hobey Baker.
Yeah. So, you know, right now the slow walking of prospects seems to be more favored. Now, obviously, a team could slow walk a guy in the AHL. You know, the Red Wings have done a lot of that recently with Grand Rapids. So just kind of depends on what the team wants to do. So Power, where he goes is a big question mark. Beniers and Kent Johnson, same thing. Just depends on who takes them. However, if we look at just lottery picks over the last
five or so years,
of the 15 guys who were picked, you know, either had played a year in the NHL before they were, or in the NCAA before they were drafted, or were going to play after, 12 of those 15 guys all just played in the NCAA at least one more year after being drafted.
After being drafted?
Yeah.
So, okay. And did any of them get plural years afterwards?
A bunch of them from last year, or from 2019.
Okay.
So guys in their second year now. So Matthew Boldy is back at BC for a second year. Spencer Knight is back at BC for a second year. Cam York is back at Michigan for a second year. And Cole Caulfield's back at Wisconsin for a second year.
That was a little surprising.
So, you know, that totally can happen. And the last two times Michigan had a situation like Beniers or Johnson or Power, both those guys got one more year after being drafted, Zach Werenski and Quinn Hughes.
Right.
So they played 1 year before being drafted and 1 year after. So my conservative projection would be that most of them probably come back just because teams tend to slow walk guys nowadays. That's what the history shows, but this is a weird year and teams make their own decisions and it's kind of impossible to know.
So you're pretty much thinking York is gone and everyone else is...
Power I'm iffy on. The other guys I lean towards coming back just simply because that's what tends to happen.
Even Johnny Beecher.
Beecher, it's tough to know.
Beecher's tough because of, yeah, there's a lot with him in terms of his production, in terms of somewhat how he's used, and there's a lot of teams that view him in different ways.
I mean, this is what you do when you recruit these guys, right? If you don't want this conversation, then you can go and recruit 20-year-olds. And, you know, Michigan State doesn't have this conversation every year. I mean, a few programs do. BC does, BU does, Michigan, North Dakota. It's only a few schools, and you have to live with uncertainty when you do this.
All right, so...
And by the way, I want to put a quick clarification. Chalowski played in the WHL, not the BCHL, after the Wings ripped him out of St. Cloud.
I see.
He was in the BCHL before that.
So Michigan had a really good class coming into this year. They also have a really good class coming into next year. In just a couple minutes, what do you think that looks like?
Yeah, it's another really good group. And, you know, unless this year really goes poorly or something happens, I would expect Michigan to have really top-tier talent all the time in the near future, because that's what Mel seems to want. And Michigan's proximity to the USNTDP, in addition to the history, etc., means that they should probably be getting those guys a lot. And next year's class definitely looks a lot like that. So you've got only one top 10 type-ish guy, only one, in Luke Hughes, who is a Hughes.
Of Quinn nature.
So he's the younger brother of Quinn and Jack. Jack didn't play at Michigan. He decided to go to the NHL and be very, very bad as a rookie. legitimately, potentially the worst rookie season for a number one pick in 20 years. But
wow.
Yeah, not great. He's young, though. Give him time.
Continue.
Anyway, so Luke Hughes is going to follow Quinn's path and not Jack's path, and he's going to go to college, and he's going to play at Michigan. And like Quinn, Luke is a defenseman, whereas Jack's a center. Luke is the tall one in the family. He outgrew Quinn and Jack quite considerably, so he doesn't have that attached to him. Like the other brothers, he is an exceptional skater. I don't know what that family's genetics are, but whatever it is, they're very good at skating. And he's a guy that just a lot of people really like, and he's kind of a consensus top 10. He is in that conversation to go one overall. He's one of those 8 or 10 names. So, you know, if power gets ripped out, then you can plug Hughes right in, because he's going to be a similar blue chip type guy. Outside of that, there's Mackie, which is his nickname, Matthew Samoskovich, who plays in the USHL, I believe, on the Chicago Steel, good team.
Yep.
He's kind of first, second round fringe, the Bordalo territory, I guess, right on that edge of the first, second round. There's also Dylan Duke, who's also a projected first rounder in this upcoming draft. He's a center for the USNTDP. So if all goes well, you could have 3 first-rounders coming in next year if Samoskovich wiggles his way in and Duke wiggles his way in. Depends on where they get picked. But outside of that, Ethan Edwards, a defenseman, was a 4th-round pick in this past draft, who's going to come in at 19. And that was kind of a surprising pick. He wasn't really on the radar a lot, and he got snagged there. There's a couple other names. Luca Fantilli, the older brother of Adam Fantilli, who is talked about as a top pick in 2022 or 2023 draft. He's very, very young. Talk about reclassification. Brian talks about this all the time. Yeah. I've only followed it a little bit. But, you know, those are decent names. Cole McWard, another defenseman. It's a very defense-heavy class, at least in the names that are sure committed. Marcus Stoppa flips from WMU, seems like an okay player. So it's going to be, you know, a few pedestrian names, and then probably 2 to 3 first-round picks. A
couple fireworks.
Yep. So, and that's kind of what you should expect moving forward. I mean, if you want to look at the 2022 class, guess what? There's 2 guys in there that are projected top 10, top 20 picks. And I think that should just be our expectation every year moving forward.
And then the last question that's kind of tied to this is, what are recruiting needs? But it sounds like where Michigan is at is they're just getting as many good players as possible. And they're just stacking talent and moving it around as necessary, but they're just, it looks like, unless, like you said, something goes terribly wrong, they're just going to have a bunch of talent in the next at least few years.
I mean, let's face it, Michigan hockey as a program is in the, you know, Alabama, Texas, USC, Ohio State tier for football, the Duke, North Carolina. I mean, it's one of the 2 or 3 best programs. And you know, Minnesota's the only team, I think, outside of Michigan that should have more talent than them on a yearly basis. I mean, when you have that many, the history, the, you know, the program prestige, you're in a pretty good state for local talent, you have the proximity to the USN TDP, you have just a gigantic army of former players that are now in the NHL that you can point to, including, you know, Quinn Hughes, Werenski, Larkin. I mean, even guys like Compher and Mott who have carved it. I mean, there was, we were there when they had all those cardboard cutouts. It's a lot of dudes. Michigan is a pathway to the NHL. And when you are that prestige of a program, you should get that top talent. This isn't, I mean, Mel's recruiting really well, but this isn't like something shocking. I mean, right. I don't think Mel is bagging right now. Like, this is just Michigan's a top-tier program, and they're getting players because they're a top-tier program.
All right. Well, now we'll transition into the next question, which is, okay, so this guy is asking about modern hockey archetypes. And, you know, we kind of talk about Power being a unicorn as a defenseman because he's so long, he's so tall, but can skate so well. I mean, he's not, like, that's not how defensemen are generally are, right? I mean, like, you don't just have a Victor Hedman clone machine. So what are other sort of archetypes for, like, say, a number one center? Or are there any? Because here's the other thing, is it's like, this is a very in down to details question, because then you have to ask, all right, are we talking about, like, for the Avs or the Golden Knights or the Red Wings, or are we talking about for Michigan, Minnesota, BC? Because those are going to be two different things. Like, you're never going to see Connor McDavid or Nathan MacKinnon in college hockey. You might see, like, a TJ Hensick, who was here for 4 years, lit everybody on fire, and then couldn't really do anything in the NHL, but he worked out pretty well for Michigan.
Sure. They're a lot of better. I mean, I don't know. There have been plenty of great players who have played college hockey recently. I mean, Casey Mittelstadt hasn't made it in the NHL yet, but he was really, really good when he played at Minnesota that one year. And
right, but that's for a year. But Hensick was here for 4 years. So I'm talking about, like, you look at guys like Kevin Porter, won Hobey Baker, was great for 4 years. That's like a program-long guy. And maybe that was just, you know, a generation ago. But, you know, they're just different ways to look at this.
I mean, with college hockey, I don't really think there's anything I can really say about an archetype for college hockey. It's just kind of who's good, you know? I mean, some teams like Michigan try to get the 18, 19-year-olds. Some try to get more established program guys. I mean, it just kind of depends on what you're trying to do. But in terms of what scouts look for, at least in the NHL level nowadays, it kind of depends, right? There isn't one mold. And that's, I think, one of the nice things about sports, but really, you know, hockey in general, is that there are a lot of different ways you can build your team.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you think about, just pick out any era, and the top players in that era, they're not all the same. They have different ways they go about things. And, you know, if you pick out, let's say we want to go back, you know, to the 90s, for example. You know, you had guys in that era. I mean, you know, Mario Lemieux was a superhuman. But he was an offensive guy. You know, Mario and Gretzky as well. I mean, they occasionally played on the penalty kill, but were not really there as defensive players. They were more just there to put pressure on the defense about an opposing rush. I mean, they were not much of defensive players, but their offensive production way outpaced them.
Right.
On the flip side, that same era, you know, you had guys like Joe Sakic and Steve Yzerman, and then, you know, their fellow teammates in Forsberg and Fedorov, who were just all phenomenal defensive centers. And several of them won Selkies as the best defensive forward in the league. So those are different ways you can go about it. Some teams want their number one center to be more of a two-way guy. But if you get a Connor McDavid, who doesn't really play any defense, but scores like no one else in the league, you're fine with that too.
Yeah.
And, you know, yes, you want a bigger guy in theory, like an Owen Power. But guess what? Quinn Hughes is small and he's great. And you want a bigger guy like Quentin Byfield, who was just taken second overall by the Kings. But guess what? Braden Point is 5'9", and he's one of the best 5 or 10 centers in the league for Tampa and just won a cup. So, like, you can kind of do whatever.
It's not like sort of football where
there's just
you can
standard
be
heights.
Undersized, and if you're not, you're not going to be able to do what you're supposed to do.
No, I mean, guys can succeed at any level. I mean, obviously, if you get smaller and smaller, then it gets tough. And if you get bigger and bigger, then it can be harder
to
skate.
You can be too big.
Yeah.
I mean, you want to be able to skate. I mean, that's the first thing. Can a guy skate? Because if he can't skate, he's going to be limited in a lot of roles.
But there are still guys who didn't really skate and who became great players. I mean, Ron Francis was never a great skater. Luke Robitaille couldn't skate at all and, you know, found ways through positioning, through a great shot, to be able to get around it. Obviously, if a guy can't skate, that's a problem. But some guys find a way around it. Okay. So, it just kind of depends on the player. It kind of depends on the position. It's what a team wants, you know. I, for example, aren't as big of a fan of the Quinn Hughes, Cale Makar model of defenseman. I prefer more of a balanced stay at the blue line type, but I also just grew up on Lidstrom and Rafalski and Cronwall and guys like that who were just more balanced, didn't rush up all the time, that kind of thing. Just depends on what you want. And
I think a little bit you can want a mix of both, right? Like that's how you set a pairing, is if you have a guy that's going to go forward, you also want a guy with him that's going to cover for him defensively.
Yeah. And so it just depends on what the team is looking for. And there are a lot of different ways to go about it. And, you know, we were talking before the show, Scott Stevens is a classic example of how what a team is looking for can affect the player. And that Scott Stevens was a phenomenal offensive defenseman in the 80s with the Capitals and then into his early years with the Devils. He was a 70-point player in 94. And then in 95, Jacques Lemaire institutes the first real, you know, big neutral zone trap with the Devils. And Scott Stevens' defense went way up. His offense trailed off considerably and by the end was not playing on the power play much at all and was fine. And, you know, totally changed his game to be more of a defensive-focused guy because that's what the team wanted. That's what the system was. And I don't know if there was ever a conversation between him and Jacques Lemaire, but I imagine there was, where we need you to stay home more. And he was fine with it, and, you know, they were able to win a lot.
They won cups, so.
Yeah. So sometimes it just, and Scott Niedermeyer's the flip side of that, who was just constantly constrained in New Jersey. And the moment he got out of the Devils, when he went to Anaheim, his offense just skyrocketed because he was finally able to play how he wanted to. So it just kind of comes down to the guy and what style you're going to play.
Yeah, like the coaching system and how you fit into of other people. You know, I think that was another point that is like, you also want, you know, the better players you want to be able to put them maybe sometimes with weaker players like a Crosby who carries some guys. And you know, you can put guys that aren't quite as good and he can adapt to them and do the things that they don't do as well and make them better players.
And whatever the common sense consensus is can often be disproven, where you think about, and there's been such a trend towards speed and skill in the NHL, but just, you know, 2 years ago, the St. Louis Blues won the Stanley Cup, pretty much just bullying their way there. I mean, they had some really great skilled players like Petrangelo and O'Reilly and, you know, Tarasenko, guys like that. But, I mean, they were a really physical team. Every round they were hitting, they were agitating.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, Don Cherry was very happy to see that. So that's the battle between analytics and everyone else, right? I mean, there seems to be this, you know, this is what we're looking for. But other teams can say, no, we've got a better formula, and sometimes it works.
Yep. No, that's true. Okay, so we have a few questions now that are a little more not as hockey specific, so to speak, but one guy wanted to know what we thought of those kind of faded white yellow uniforms that they wore at the end of the Minnesota series.
They were all right. And they were throwbacks, right?
Were they? I didn't see anything.
That's what I thought.
Okay.
But I don't know.
So my thing
when
is...
When you see that kind of thing, you expect it to throw back.
It's okay.
But
it's okay. Michigan did that in an outdoor game in Chicago, I think against Michigan State, probably like 5 years ago, 6 years ago now. But my thing sort of is Michigan has great colors. They generally have good uniforms. A lot of that stuff to me is sort of unnecessary. Like if you give them a maize jersey and you put an M on it, or you write Michigan, and some people like the... What is it? The reflective sort of material that Michigan used to have on the, you know, that sort of thing. Like, that's fine. But, I mean, Michigan's maize and blue is pretty great, and I get that you want to wear white sometimes at home to clash with whatever your opponent is, but I think that those are pretty good colors, and my opinion is I don't really need to see, like, cream or something.
My take is that college hockey should move in the NHL direction and go with colors at home as opposed to white at home.
Oh, sure.
College hockey is still stuck in the pre-2004 NHL era where
football's always done that.
Yeah. I just like the Mays jersey should just be the home jersey. That's my opinion. Unless they were going to do those all whites that they did. Remember that outdoor game against Notre Dame?
The Stormtrooper uniforms?
Those are really clean looking. Maybe it was just the outdoor environment that they meshed well in, but yeah. I enjoyed those a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, people try to get so greedy with uniforms, and they try to do too much. I mean, there's always talk about, you know, should the Red Wings add a third uniform? Should the Tigers do something else? It's like, no. You have a great logo. You have great uniforms. You don't need to do that. Like, the Yankees don't need alternate uniforms.
Well,
like,
no. It's just... I think it depends who you are. Like, Oregon has built a tradition in football
right.
of making awesome uniforms. And that's great. And I love it. And I look forward to that every week, finding out what are they going to wear. And it usually looks pretty sweet.
I mean, we do this with Michigan football, too, where people are just... I mean, remember the weird lemon Gatorade ones they wore against Florida? And
the bananas?
Whatever. And the... You know, different ones they wore in the Under the Lights games, and just there's no need for that.
But that was...
Let's just wear uniforms. That's your thing. You have great uniforms. Wear your great uniforms. You don't need to
right.
do more.
And that's sort of what my point with Oregon was, is they built their program on doing things like that. But do you want to see Alabama or Penn State have alternate jerseys? No.
No.
They're classic in what they do, and what they... Like the Yankees. I don't want to see the Yankees wear, like, some weird opposite... stripes or, you know, things like that. Like, that would be ridiculous.
I don't want to see the Yankees at all, so.
Thanks for playing along, Alex. okay, is there anything specific that we should be looking for at the World Juniors? You had a great answer the first time I asked you this.
I just said I want to watch the World Juniors.
You just hope they play games.
Yeah, I mean, apparently the COVID thing is actually in control. They said the other day that
okay.
they did 3,000 PCR tests and there were only like 10 positives and those people are quarantining. So, and all the teams are now in Edmonton, so they all are there bubbling, getting ready to go. So I think they should be okay. You know, this is tough because there aren't a lot of draft eligibles that are playing in this tournament. Beniers as well as, you know, he's there, who else is there with him? I'm trying to remember.
With on Team USA?
Yeah.
Brisson, Beecher.
But Beecher got cut.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So did Bortolo. I'm trying to remember.
Oh, yeah.
So Beniers is the only draft eligible there, right?
Yeah, he would be the only draft eligible.
Yeah, because I was looking through the top 10. A lot of them didn't get to go. I mean, Owen Power didn't get to go.
Yeah.
Canada didn't take Brant Clark. They didn't take Carson Lambos. They didn't take Gunther.
Well,
and even
okay.
Sweden isn't taking Edvinson. They aren't taking William Eklund. So there's really... The World Juniors will be great if you are cheering for an NHL team and your team's prospects are there.
Yes.
If you're looking for this upcoming draft, there's not much to watch. A lot of those top guys are not there.
Also, Canada is super stacked. Like...
Yeah.
I mean...
So like they loaded up.
Every player is like a first-round pick.
Yeah. And every player but
insane.
One goalie is drafted. So they went with an older roster. They went with an extremely talented roster. They've got a lot of guys up front that are great and look to be really good. So, yeah. For the World Juniors, if you are a fan of a team and you want to watch your team's prospects do well, and if you want to watch Cam York or whoever, that's great. But in terms of what this is going to tell us about the upcoming draft, probably not anything. Unless Matty Beniers crushes it, in which case, then he probably rockets in the number one conversation.
All right. So the next question is Illinois getting Big Ten hockey? And if they're not, who will be next?
There doesn't seem to be anyone getting it right now.
Yeah.
Especially not with the way athletic department budgets have now been racked.
Well, that's the thing. Is like, I think Illinois was kind of on the edge. And
yeah, they were talking about it before all this.
And I've heard some conversations different places about potentially Iowa because they have all the USHL teams
yep.
in that state. So they're going to have real close connections to all these players. And they're, you know, a big enough program. So
I think I think Illinois makes the most sense. Just because Iowa, obviously, they have the USHL connections, but there's not a ton of culture there for it. I mean, my uncle lives in the West Des Moines area, and I mean, there's not much coverage of hockey in the Des Moines Register, for example. And whereas with Illinois, you can harvest Chicagoland to some extent, and there's going to be people who watch the Blackhawks and that kind of thing in that area.
If you're a good prospect, are you going to Champaign, or are you going to Notre Dame, or Minnesota, or Michigan? I mean,
are you going to Iowa City instead of Notre Dame?
No.
I mean, you're building a program anywhere. I'm just saying in terms of local support,
yeah,
helping get the team off the ground, Illinois makes the most sense. I mean, Indiana was talked about there for a while, too.
But that's a major
stretch as well.
Yeah. I think that the Big Ten is the majority tapped out, and there might be a program like this that takes a shot, but especially with this past year or so and the way that we're dealing with money in the NCAA and everything, it's going to be, I think, difficult, at least in the near future, I'd say. All right, so then the last thing this guy says is predictions about three things. One, highest scorer, two, MVP, and three, defensive MVP. So we can do these in pairs. Your highest scorer.
I'm sticking with Beniers.
Yeah, I'm going with him or Bortolo.
That's the other option.
So it's going to probably be one of those two guys, I would think. I can't see too many other people. They just create so much, so you're always going to get assists, and they also play a ton on the power play that when Michigan is fully functioning with all their players again, I mean, it's just going to be really hard for them to not have a lot of points, I think. Unless Michigan just doesn't have any points, which doesn't seem likely, but it's probably going to be one of those two guys. I guess team MVP?
I mean, the most obvious answer is Strauss Mann.
I mean, that's what I was thinking.
But outside of that, honestly, you can go with Bortolo or Beniers just because of how much different the offense looked when they were not there in the Minnesota series. I don't really think anyone on the defense merits it at the moment.
Well, all right, so...
And Mann started every game, so it's hard not to go with that.
So defensive MVP, I don't know if this is reference to on defense or if, like, you know, goalie counts. Let's say goalie counts, so we give...
I'd say goalie doesn't count.
Doesn't count?
Yeah.
Oh, you're changing all the rules on me. All right, so the best player... Who's the best defensive... Basically the best defenseman?
Sure.
Okay. At the end of the year... And this isn't necessarily points. It's going to be just, what, looks and feels and happiness?
However you define it.
So in the end of the year, who are you going to look back on and say, this is the best defenseman? Not, like, defenseman of this year, like, that played the best this year.
Blankenberg.
Oh. You're already dumping Jacob Trescott? Is that just a fling? Like, were you guys just coming out for, like,
I'm talking about all-around ability. And Blankenberg adds an element to the team that York matches, but York's been creaky.
York's had some crazy DZTOs.
Yep. And Blankenberg, I mean, again, he gets pushed around too much, but outside of that, he's fundamentally sound defensively, and he's just done stuff that, you know, he's such a weapon on the power play with the wrist shot, and we saw him put on the Jets against Penn State, and, you know, he's just all around... abilities, and as an older guy and a leader on the team, he could be really crucial down the stretch.
I don't think I can argue somebody better than that. That makes a lot of sense. I was like, all right, I got to take somebody different, and I went through all the defensemen in my mind.
Keaton Pearson was playing well defensively, except for that one incident from last week.
Jake Kerenen, maybe?
Kerenen is the surprise.
He's been fine. He's been good. As a guy who's like wasn't expected to play a lot.
He's the Jamon Green of this team.
Oh, God. Well, at least we got a football reference in at some point. Yes, I agree. It's probably Blankenberg. Blankenberg and Beniers.
Sure.
All right. And then this one guy wants to know, and we're kind of running over, but I'll give this quickly. This is just for Dave. What were your thoughts on the pre-Spurs Marino pre-Spurs, and what are your thoughts on Marino now? He's kind of the same guy, and... he was annoying to play against. I think he's still annoying to watch sometimes, but he's effective. And when you have guys like Sun and Kane that are scoring at insane levels, like, it can work. I don't know how sustainable it is. Spurs were, he out-dueled Klopp, I think, in the Liverpool game, but it didn't work out, and they kind of got unlucky on both of sort of Liverpool's goals, and that Bergwijn couldn't finish one. So I've come around to respect it a little bit more because he's actually brought some stability defensively to Spurs, but I don't know. I don't know that many other people are going to be able to play at that level the way that he does, and he's eventually going to set the organization on fire because he has everywhere. I hope that they win a trophy or two while he's there, and then it won't really matter, but if he can win games, I guess I can be okay with it. At least in the short term, because I don't think that there's probably going to be a long term. Matt Campbell, and you can jump in on this. I know that you watch a lot of Tottenham and Iowa State, but I tweeted something on Saturday that I was really proud of Matt Campbell and what he had done at Iowa State and what the Iowa State program had done, because mentioning them in New Year's Six Bowl seemed ridiculous. As my mom went to Iowa State, and so I've watched the team since the McCartney era, back in the late 90s and early 2000s. And just thinking of them even making the Big 12 title game was an absurd thought to me. And they did it, and they could have won that game Saturday. So I'm looking at that from an Iowa State perspective. I'm not necessarily looking at it from a Michigan perspective. Do I, as a Michigan fan, do I want him to come here? I don't know. I would warn him against coming here. I think there are other issues at Michigan, and a guy like him is in a situation where he's in a really good spot at Iowa State. He can pick whatever job he wants. And I would say that, honestly, the way that the Big 12 is shaping up right now, you might as well stick around in the Big 12 for a little bit, unless you want to go to the NFL.
How does Matt Campbell compare to Gene Chizik?
You mean at Iowa State? I don't know. Give him Cam Newton and we'll find out.
He's the worst coach to win a national title, right? Like, we all agree about this.
I mean, Cam Newton did it. It was the Cam Newton everything.
Yeah.
He rescued them in like three games that year that they probably should have lost. That team wasn't very good.
Gene Chizik had three losing seasons out of five if you take out
also
the Cam Newton year.
Also, Oregon almost beat them in the title game. Like, they played in 50-50, and Oregon lost contain on one play, and they went all the way down the field, kicked a field goal, and won. So
my favorite memory of that is that it was the Tostitos National Championship game, and when they trot out the kicker to win it, Brent Musburger thinks he's all cool, and he's like, for all the Tostitos.
That's, you know, we do have similar senses of humor, I think.
Yeah.
We can both appreciate that thing. So that's my thing.
Matt
about...
Campbell's not coming here. Harbaugh's going to be back.
That's fine. And I go with that. I think Campbell has a nice situation because he doesn't have to face Ohio State, doesn't have to face Clemson, he doesn't have to face Alabama. And as good as Oklahoma is, his record against them is actually, he's beaten them twice, and he was 30 yards from beating them, or a Chase Allen catch inside the 10-yard line from potentially beating them on Saturday. So when that's who you have to face to win your division, and they won the regular season. I mean, they went 8-1. Like, yeah, it's a COVID year, you can say whatever you want, but I mean,
if I were him, the only jobs I would take is like do what Mack Brown did or Herm did. Just pick out some pedestrian school and a not very good conference with no expectations and go there.
I mean, that's,
if you're
gonna
leave Iowa State, that's the only place I would go.
Unless you
somewhere
wanna
that pays you a little bit more and that's it.
Unless, like, you want to go to the NFL.
Even the NFL's risky.
Yeah, but I mean, some guys, that's what their goal is. They want to win a Super Bowl. And so I'm never going to blame a guy for going to the NFL and taking a shot. I'm saying in college football, where the deck is generally stacked against you unless you're at, you know, four or five schools, like, he's also making like $3 million a year. It's not like he's not making anything, right? So, yeah, I guess if you want your extra $4 or $5 million and then get fired at a big school, you can. But, like, I don't know. It just depends what he wants. Somebody wants me to talk about Wolves in Everton. Now, do you think they actually mean, like, Wolves?
I thought you meant real Wolves.
Well, that's what I mean. Do you think they actually want to talk about, like, actual wolves? Do you have anything to say about wolves? Ooh, I caught you off guard. Man, I've blindsided you three times, and you just rolled
My only wolf fact is that there was a ballot proposition in Colorado this year about whether to reintroduce the gray wolf into the wild, which I didn't really understand why that was on the ballot. It feels like something that people that know what they're doing should be talking about and not average citizens voting, but I don't know. If you like gray wolves, go to the UP or something.
So, and then my favorite thing about Everton is, and they're having a good year, and they've had a couple of good Americans go through there. So
that's where Tim Howard played, right?
Tim Howard and Donovan had some loans there. But so my favorite thing is, my buddy is a Spurs fan, and we were looking up great team names that, like, people have in their local soccer leagues. And the thing about Everton is, like, they've never generally been traditionally good enough to be in the top four and make Champions League consistently. They kind of dance around with Europa League, but usually they end up failing and getting down somewhere between 6 and 12 or 10 or whatever in the table. And so they're just sort of caught in purgatory, sort of like Michigan. And somebody named their pickup soccer team Whateverton. And I was like, oh, that's my favorite. So if you want more than that, I'm not your guy to talk about Everton or Wolves. Or Wolves. But you have political ambitions as a wolf, it sounds like. Or did I not hear you, what you said?
No, I was just, that's all I know about wolves. Thank you for for listening to Michigan Hockey Cast 3.7. For David Nasternak and Alex Drain, come back in the future where we'll be more on topic, because then hockey will be back.